Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Looking for the perfect First Communion, Confirmation, or RCIA gift? Consider a beautiful, heirloom-quality, made-in-Italy rosary from Ghirelli. A Ghirelli rosary will be prayed with and cherished forever, guaranteed. Shop Ghirelli today. That's ghirelli.com.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets. On a topic related to the human condition, hopefully, bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little light into our culture of death. As you can see, to your either left or right, depending on your perspective, my guest and yours, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Bob.
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Complain, I can't. Yourself?
I can't complain either. I cannot complain. Complain, I can't.
Complain, you can't too.
Yeah, there you go.
You doing all right today? You ready to delve beneath the surface?
Well, it's been a busy day for me, and I tried to get some walking in before the snow was coming, you know?
Yeah, 3 to 6 inches?
Yeah.
Something like that? Yeah, good. Good. Well, tonight's topic, tonight we're going to delve beneath the surface on the topic of the abolition of man and the modern Prometheus. The abolition of man and the modern Prometheus. There's a lot of meat here that I'm sure you are going to tell us about, Mr. Bob. This is your topic that you wanted to go to delve on, and I said, sure.
Go beneath the surface.
Go BTS on it. So let's begin with the fact that this title relates to two particular classic books, no?
Sure does.
Why don't you explain to our audience so we can get into this?
Okay, well, The Abolition of Man is a book by C.S. Lewis. I actually fell in love with this book just as I was thinking about my return to Catholicism. And it mystified me. It brought up questions. It's one of those books that really gets you questioning things. And I was rereading it today, and I discovered how much I understood it better than when I first read it.
Interesting. Well, that's what happens sometimes when you get a different you read it from a different perspective.
Well, yes, and especially in the perspective that C.S. Lewis was talking about. You have to remember that C.S. Lewis was writing this generally around the time of World War II.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. For those who don't know C.S. Lewis, he was he lived in the 20th century.
Yes, he did.
He was a philosopher, historian.
A lot of people don't know this, but he was trained as a philosopher, but he he got into the literary side of things.
Yes, and he's a prolific writer, a lot of books.
Yes, he did. He's The Chronicles of Narnia is very famous. There've been a few movies that have been made on that, and he is really well known as a Christian apologist. And yes.
And Peter Kreeft is somebody who sees him as one of his, you know, top three people that formed him.
Yes. Well, the interesting thing about C.S. Lewis is that he was not a Catholic himself, but he has brought a lot of Catholics back into the faith or into the Catholic faith.
Yeah, he was very Catholic-like.
Yes, he was. He's definitely like one. Was.
So one of his, would you say one of his more popular books was The Abolition of Man?
I'm not sure. I actually remember wanting to write a paper on that in college, and both the professor and I admitted that this was a book from a previous age. An educated person would have difficulty reading this book back in the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century. Yeah. And now I think the book is almost out of grasp, out of college graduates.
Is that because we have dumbed down education, or is it because the language and modes of speaking have evolved and changed?
Well, it depends on what you mean by education. I think our educational system is working just fine for what it intends to do. But if you talk about a liberal education in the sense that the whole point of a liberal education is to give somebody freedom to fulfill their humanity, their human nature, that's what I'm talking about, a liberal education. And that sort of progress in the humanities has actually really gone downhill really since before the 20th century started. And in fact, what the book, The Abolition of Man, is exactly starting with that point.
Yes, that's a good point. The more we lose touch with human nature, our very humanity, what it means to be a human being, the more we are at danger of being abolished as a species. And I bet, I between you and I in a lamppost, I haven't read this book of C.S. Lewis yet, but I bet that's what it's about.
It is very much about that, yes. All right. He starts with the virtues. He starts with, because he's the people, he's actually was given a book to review. And it was by some educators, you know, for a higher level education for schoolboys and girls. Mm. And he said, well, the thing is that what they're trying to educate people in English, you know, in grammar. But he's discovering the philosophy that's underlying the writers of this book. And he's saying, no, this can't be. What you're saying is wrong. They were trying to promote reason in the modern sense of the word, reason above humanity, in a human sort of way, not above humanity in a godlike sort of way. I'm thinking about the way modern progressives tend to exalt reason. To the exclusion.
Well, you're talking about the movement that began with the Enlightenment.
Yes.
And ultra-rationalism. And
yes.
It basically is saying reason can understand all that we need to understand, and it doesn't lead us to anything beyond reason. Whereas I think you're about to say that C.S. Lewis and the Christian understanding is that reason is a wonderful tool, and it gets us past the senses, but it points us to faith.
Well, he's not explicit in this, in The Abolition of Man. This is a book written for non-Christians and Christians alike. But in reading this, I don't think you can help but become a Christian. But it's not an apologetic book.
So basically, what did you get out of it? What do you want to share with the audience?
Well, he started with the virtues. If you remember David Hume, he started seeing that our values were nothing more than representations of emotion. And this is what the educators were bringing out. They were saying when writers from the past would make value statements, yes, these educators would go and say, well, that's just emotion. He's just expressing his emotion. He's not expressing a value statement.
Right. Well, they didn't believe that there was objective truth, and hence there were no properly objectively ordered values, right? So when somebody says X is bad, they're really saying X is displeasing to me.
Right, exactly.
Philosophy, because there is no objective truth regarding this. It's all subjective.
So C.S. Lewis was tying this with the virtues. And one of his very important points here about the virtues is that you need to train these little human beings, you know, what the educators are trying to do. You need to train these human beings to become human. It's not natural, so to speak, for these little children to grow into civilized men and women. And
This is the problem of not bringing in a Judeo-Christian heritage to it, because, you know, we understand that it's actually the reason why it doesn't come natural, even though it's part of our human nature, is because of original sin and the devastation
exactly
it did to us. So in that sense, we need to overcome the imbalance within us caused by original sin in order to become human. And that's really what the virtues are, right? We temper our disordered appetites, and we have courage, our fortitude to overcome those obstacles that we're sometimes fearful of, or we're too lazy to do and we know we should do it. Basically, that's what the virtues begin as, right? Overcoming our sinful nature.
Sure. So C.S. Lewis was, you know, I even encountered this as I was reading it today. I understand now a lot of people interpret C.S. Lewis as trying to say that he's trying to eliminate emotions. And that's actually not true. That's not what C.S. Lewis is trying to do. What he's trying
whenever somebody says that you need to govern your emotions by your higher nature, the intellect and will, others immediately say, "Oh, so we're supposed to just suppress our emotions?" No, that's not what we're saying. We're saying that our emotions can be like wild animals at times. We need to try to tame them and govern them according to the true and the good.
Well, this is the point that C.S. Lewis is trying to make.
Yeah, not eliminate them.
Right. Actually train the emotions.
Yeah.
To build up the emotions so that the emotions are rightly ordered to the situation.
Right. And rightly ordered for the good.
For the good, exactly. It's not eliminating emotions, but rather, what is your response going to be? A person in any particular situation is not going to go out and kind of go through the reasoning of why he shouldn't kill a person or whether he should save the human being or save the dog. I'm referring to your question that you asked your students.
Yes.
It's something that through the training of virtues, through the humanities, that they understand almost instinctively, sort of, so to speak, what they should do in any particular sort of situation.
So it's like practicing. When you practice the virtues, they more and more become like second nature to the person.
Absolutely. And that's the sort of thing that he was trying to work with. And he was seeing that these educators, it was part of a... It seemed to be a part of a larger movement, because he just didn't stop at the virtues.
Yeah.
He saw that what these educators were trying to do is they were actually trying to subvert the natural law.
Yes.
And that goes into the next step in the abolition of man is that they started making arguments and saying, well, this part of the natural law isn't rational. You know, we need to overturn these old taboos. Remember earlier we talked about Hume's dealing with these values, these absolute value statements, and treating them as merely just emotional reactions to things. I find something disgusting, therefore, you know, that's why I think it's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, many philosophers call this the moral philosophy of emotivism.
Right.
There is no objective values, therefore, we're just, like you said earlier, it's just an expression of our displeasure or our pleasure.
Right.
Yeah.
He goes into the second essay about how they really don't have a leg to stand on, or they're tearing away the foundation of any sort of argument that they would make. And so if you try to eliminate part of the natural law, the type part that they want to get rid of, that they think is irrational or whatever, and the issue actually predominant in C.S. Lewis's mind at that time was actually contraception. And unlike, he was an Anglican himself, and unlike the rest of the Anglican church.
When was this book written?
This was written, I think, in 1944. It was definitely written after the Lambeth Conference.
Yeah, okay.
The Lambeth Conference in 1930, the Anglican Communion said it was permissible within marriage to use contraception.
In rare kind of almost emergency kind of cases, not as a rare
right.
And of course, that was, for those who don't know, that was the first crack in the door of all of Christianity in the history of Christianity, that a denomination accepted the possibility of somebody using artificial contraception. All of Christianity was in union with its condemnation as violating natural law until the Anglicans opened that door a crack in 1930. And of course, from that point on, all of the Protestant denominations kind of followed like dominoes. And I don't know if there is any body other than maybe any community other than maybe naturalists, other than the Catholic Church, who still condemn the use of contraception. Okay.
So, this is the sort of thing he goes into a very detailed argument about the natural law. And one thing that you'll notice about what he's doing here is I think the natural law in several shades of natural law has a bad reputation, even back then in the middle of the 20th century.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of people referred to the natural law in the Kantian sense. I'm not sure of this, but it's not the natural law that we inherited from Aristotle or something like that.
And, so it's basically it's just a duty-based thing,
right?
That has no correlation to objective reality, particularly correlating to human nature.
But people still use the term natural law. And I find many authors who have said, well, okay, I'm talking about natural law, but I'm not talking about this bad kind of natural law. C.S. Right. Lewis was a medievalist. He was actually involved in the translation of the legend about King Arthur. In the books that I have, he's written an essay that's part of the prologue to that book. But so he was definitely a medieval sort of person. He wasn't really a person of the Enlightenment, just to give you kind of a situation. So it puts him in the sort of the same category as we are in the Catholic Church. We don't disregard Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, and I don't think C.S. Lewis did either.
Right. Okay, so just to encapsulate something that you're hitting on here, that the crescendo of natural law theory really hit its highest zenith in the Middle Ages and Upper Middle Ages. And then from there, slowly into modernity, you get what you were saying, that is what's the chipping away at natural law, and yet still calling it natural law.
And that's right.
Chipping away, and I would say all the way to the 20th century, where finally, I think, most of the non-Catholic worlds just threw out natural law.
Yes.
Forget the morphed, imbalanced versions of it. They just, I think they get to a point where they just threw it out. They don't catch human nature. We'll get rid of that as a concept altogether.
Right, and I think with some justification, because these lesser forms of natural law are not really entirely coherent.
They're distorted and unreasonable.
Right.
Right.
And so C.S. Lewis took to calling natural law the Tao. He used the Chinese word T-A-O.
Yeah.
As his word that he was going to use for the talking about natural law. And the other reason that he was using this word was he was trying to show the universality of natural law.
Okay. Well, we're almost at halftime here. So where are we going with this?
Well, we're going into the next step, the abolition of man.
And so are you saying that, if I can just, put it in a nutshell, that the chipping away and the discarding of true natural law was the destruction of the foundation of humanity?
Yes, it is the beginning, so to speak, of
the abolition of man. Okay.
Right.
So then continue.
Okay. So we chip away at the foundation of natural law, and so we advance in science, and we advance in our control over the environment and all these sorts of things, and we encounter it even now. If we were to talk about something like stem cell research, the attitude of your modern scientist, your typical modern scientist will be, well, why would it be a problem to mess with embryonic stem cells? Why would it be a problem to mess with these embryos and
yeah, it's interesting how they it's just not like intuitive that, you know, if human beings begin a conception and you're messing with embryos, then you are discarding, you're killing human beings in order to try to save others. It's a totally utilitarian point of view. Are you saying that this attitude that many have today relate to the discarding of natural law?
Well, yes. There is this idea that reason, or this exaggerated sense of reason, I guess I should say that just so that we're not confused, that we're not against reason here. We're looking for a more coherent version of the natural law, rather than this exaggerated view of reason that takes out the view of the nature of man.
Well, you can't really have pure reason if there isn't an object of reason. So in other words, reason relates to what is reasonable, how things in the external world are properly ordered, right? That's what
reason
is able to distinguish and understand. If you have a Kantian understanding of reason, you take that out. And reason is just all alone by itself. So you create a principle, and you try to dutifully follow it. And you're right, if it has no direct correlation to the natural world, then what is it?
Yeah.
It becomes unreasonable.
One of the things we've talked about in the past is this view of knowledge as power.
Yes.
This is, I think it's Francis Bacon. I'm not.
Was sure. Yes. Yes.
Who talked about knowledge as power, and this is the time period when modern science is being given birth the way we understand it today.
I got to take a break, Bob, but I think you hit on something huge, and that is the modern movement is all about power. It used to be about learning and discovering, and now instead of trying to understand being, we try to manipulate it and to use it for our benefit, and that's a different way of looking at reason and philosophy. But we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. We're talking about the abolition of man, and we'll finish this up. And after the break, that is, we will get into this notion of and the modern Prometheus, and how that relates to the abolition of man. Listening to Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface, segment number two, guest Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Bob, welcome back.
Hey, it's nice to be back.
It's nice to be back. And so we are, for the first half of Beneath the Surface, we talked about the abolition of man by C.S. Lewis, and how through, through modernity, the natural law theory was disfigured, disformed, and later modernity finally just cast out as something that is not the working foundation for understanding humanity anymore, I suppose you could say. And the problem with this, of course, Bob, is you have to replace natural law with something. And I think the two things that replaced it rather quickly were a utilitarian consequentialism and a moral relativism. That's really what we're dealing with today in this huge movement, most of what people would call the left or progressivism. Yes?
Yes, no, I agree. You're saying stuff that I agree with here.
Since it's a radio show, a podcast, you're supposed to tell me why you agree with that.
All right, I will. It's an overthrowing of what we've been handed down. I definitely believe in what Chesterton would call the democracy of the dead.
Yes. Yes.
And it's not saying that I want to rigidly adhere to old-fashioned values or things that my father and my grandfather and so forth held on to. It's not saying that the natural law, its understanding can't be improved by men, but rather we're saying this is really a foundation that has proven itself, has shown its reliability over time. I think. It's been.
Well, I think that every culture universally has utilize the natural law without even recognizing it sometimes.
Yes. I think so.
Every culture has a form of regulation of the Ten Commandments in some form or another. And the Ten Commandments are simply, they were given by God to Moses, but they are simply the 10 precepts of the natural law.
Right, right. And that is part of what C.S. Lewis did in the appendix of The Abolition of Man. He has the Ten Commandments, and then what he does is that he shows how these Ten Commandments were universal.
Universally applicable. They're objective. Right. And it doesn't matter what century you live in, what gender you are, what race you are, ethnicity. As long as you share a common human nature, these commandments apply to you. And not like you were saying earlier, not simply as a duty-bound thing, but as a way to fulfill your life, as a way to achieve happiness.
Right. Well, the natural law is usually expressed in negatives, but it,
you shall not kill, you shall not steal.
Right. Yeah. But the understanding of that, and especially in Christianity, you understand that as a means toward fulfillment. This is all part of loving God and loving neighbor, and it's understood in that positive sort of sense.
In other words, God commands us to be happy.
Right, right.
Bottom line. And you can't be happy if you behave contrary to your human nature. And that's the problem with throwing out this notion of natural law, because now we're left with, there is no human nature to correspond my behaviors to, therefore I'll do what I want, I'll follow my desires, and maybe I'll be so confused that I'll think I'm the opposite sex of what I biologically am. That's how far we've gotten today in the 21st century.
Well, even still, it goes to the next step, which we're talking now about the abolition of man at one level. So a person or society that has disregarded the natural law at a very basic level, the individuals lose meaning. They don't understand how they fit in their society any longer. So just at a kind of a psychological level, they don't know what they're for.
Paul. The world's really.
Yes.
I mean, we understood basically how we are part of the world and how we fit into the world. Take away natural law, and you don't really have that foundation.
Right. Right. So. You know, I think you see that in Western society these days. You see that confusion and the depression, the loneliness, this sort of idea that you're all by yourself.
Let me put it this way, Bob. What are the first two words that a baby says in their life?
I think one of them is why, right?
Other than mama and dada, very often it's what and why. What's this? And then they get a little older. Why? Why this? Why that? What and why, right?
Yeah.
What relates to meaning, why to purpose. This is the foundation of what it means to be human. This is distinguishes us between all the other animals. We have an immaterial component. Just like stomach needs food and water, this, the soul, needs what and why. It needs meaning and purpose. Without meaning and purpose, we die inside. We're not fed forever. And I think what you're saying is that once you begin to chip away at our understanding of what it means to be a human being vis-a-vis natural law, what are we left with? Like, where's my anchor? How do I fit in? What is the meaning of life? What is the purpose? And so we have to try to create it on our own subjectively. That doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. And that's the promise. That's the promise of the kind of modern progressive movement is that we're going to reach some sort of utopia in the future, a heaven on earth, and that will never be realized. The problem will always be somebody over there or somebody in another place is not getting with the program, so to speak, and they've got to do something about that, either imprisonment or such as the gulags, or even, you know, death camps, you know, such as they had in Nazi Germany, where you've got to get rid of these terrible elements and just remove them from society.
How do you want to bring in the modern Prometheus with this?
Okay, well, the modern Prometheus comes in really with modern science added into the mix.
Okay.
And I'll just bring up Frankenstein, a book by Mary Shelley. I think most people know the basic story behind Frankenstein. So you have Frankenstein actually does not refer to the monster. It refers to the creator of the monster.
Yeah.
And in fact, I haven't read the book in quite some time, but I seem to remember that the monster really wasn't given a name. You know, it wasn't given a name, but the creator was Victor Frankenstein, the creator of the Frankenstein monster. And, you know, it was one of those books that shows kind of the horror of science. You know, what Frankenstein did was that he took various parts of bodies, and it's not the way the modern films would have it. It was actually at a much lower level, you know, of taking tissue and constructing a man out of this tissue, this very fine tissue. And I think in Mary Shelley's book, the monster was a more horrifying. He was more intelligent. In movies, they make him kind of an idiot or retarded in some sort of way.
But this guy was dangerous in the book, right?
It was very dangerous. There was a lot of chases going around, you know, Frankenstein himself being chased by his monster. And then, you know, there's this kind of
Dr. Frankenstein, you mean?
Yes, Dr. Frankenstein being chased by his monster. And so it was a book in a way that was kind of warning about
what science could do.
Yes, what science could do.
How would you put the Frankenstein monster, how do you correlate that with the Prometheus story?
Oh, well, that comes directly from the second part of the title of Mary Shelley's book. It didn't show in my version, but the second title, you know, Frankenstein and the Modern Prometheus.
That's her book. Okay.
Yeah, that's the name of the book.
And just to those who aren't familiar, Prometheus was a Greek god?
Yes, it was.
Fire?
Yeah, well, yes. This is what Prometheus did. He went behind all the other gods' back.
Yeah, and gave humanity fire first.
Gave humanity fire, it was kind of like the god said, no, you. This is the Greek equivalent of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Ah, so if you give humanity fire, you don't know what they'll do with it, right?
Right. Exactly.
Ah, okay. So now it relates to this whole Frankenstein thing. If you give man knowledge, especially if he's not grounded in natural law and virtue theory, a non-virtuous man with lots of scientific knowledge is going to create monsters. And that's the point of what you're making.
This is exactly the point that I'm making. And the reason why this sticks with me so well is my background in science fiction. One of my favorite writers was Isaac Asimov. And one of the things that he observed is that the early science fiction writers, they were writing about robots. And they were writing about these robots that were like Frankenstein's monster. It was all of a sudden, you know, men inventing these robots and these robots getting into rebellion or doing some sort of murderous thing. And Isaac Asimov, he was a big promoter of modern science. He was an atheist.
Yeah.
And he's trying to say, look, all the progress we can make with modern science, and I'm going to develop some novels here, you know, on robotics. And I'm going to show how great this advancement of robotics can be. And so he came up with the three laws of robotics. And I think a lot of people know about them. There's been a movie, I think, called I, Robot, that kind of discusses.
What? That's exactly what I was thinking of, the movie I, Robot, when you were saying this.
Okay, so he wrote I, Robot as a short story. And to tell you always movies are different from the stories that beget those. But so
I enjoyed the movie actually.
Yes, it was a very very good movie. But
with Will Smith and Tom Brady's old girlfriend.
Right, right.
Can't think of her name at the moment.
I don't remember. Yeah. Yeah. So the
Bridget base... Moynihan. Is that it? Something Moynihan? All right, never mind.
Remember her name. We're off on a tangent, Paul.
No, I know, but
So the important thing here is and it kind of goes back to natural law here. So Isaac Asimov develops these three laws of robotics, you know, something that what he needs to do is make these robots seem less horrifying. You know, they're not going to go off on their own and start killing human beings left and right.
Okay.
So he develops these three laws of robotics, and they're kind of actually kind of like the pattern of the Ten Commandments in a sort of way.
Who keeps these laws? The creator of the robotics?
These laws, and I have no idea how they're going to do it, but this is kind of like a magic sort of thing. We're going to put these three laws and embed them within the programming, or what Isaac Asimov, his science fiction was, they were positronic brains. This is actually the brain that Commander Data had in Star Trek. So that was a nod. That was a nod to Isaac Asimov. And so they're going to embed these three laws within the positronic brains. You know, the first law was that you won't harm a human being. And then the second law is that you will obey human beings unless it's going to hurt another human being.
Okay.
And then the third robotic law was one of self-preservation, if I remember correctly. Robot self-preservation. Okay. So this was trying to make the robots nice. You know, the robots aren't going to go wild. They're going to follow these laws that are built within them. I think Isaac Asimov did bring out a lot of science fiction that showed science in a less horrifying way. It was kind of an anti Frankenstein type sort of
He attempted to put some order into science and technology that is could be seen as an attempt to ground it in virtue.
Right. There was an attempt here. But this is not the way things are progressing. A lot of scientists are doing scientists without any real regard for the natural law. This is some of the big fights that we've been having. And we can start very, very early here when we talk about eugenics. Eugenics was something that came from science. You know, eugenics became a very dirty word because of the Nazi regime. You know, they were big promoters of eugenics, but eugenics was very, very popular throughout the West.
Well, it was Planned Parenthood was founded on it.
Yes, exactly. Margaret Sanger's magazine on birth control. I mean, that's where they started. They started with birth control. They at that time, Margaret Sanger thought abortion was wrong, and that was one of the reasons why you should have birth control, so that you won't have the need to have abortions.
She was targeting minority groups, wasn't she?
She was. The motto for the magazine was to create a thoroughbred of the human race.
Well, there you go. All right. So it wasn't only the Nazis. Science gave us this know-how to make a master race.
Right? Well, it comes from this idea of evolution. I'm not saying that evolution is wrong in the science, but people took that idea and ran with it, and they started thinking about, okay, how can we improve men? How can we make men better?
Right. Right. How can we assist evolution to go a little faster?
Right, right. And
that's Superman.
So this brings us to the other level of the abolition of man.
Okay. In our last 5 minutes, why don't you mention that?
All right. So what happens then is then you're going to go and you're in your conquest of nature, you're going to conquer the nature of man.
Yes. I see what you're saying. So it's not only is the project to conquer all of our nature around us, but our human nature itself.
Yes, yes.
And really, that's what contraception tries to do.
Yes, and so the conquest of human nature. Well, if you understand Aristotle, if you understand that what we're talking about is a nature that is fixed in a certain sort of way. So if you're going to destroy human nature, what you're really doing is putting something new in its place. You're replacing man, and you're replacing it with this new man.
It becomes a new species.
It becomes a new species. When
you get rid of the essence or the substance, it becomes something else. So yeah. So then basically they're saying they're trying to create a species that's more than human. It's kind of a superhuman species.
Right, right. Yes, and that goes to Nietzsche right there.
Exactly.
We've got to go to this next stage, the superhuman person, and that definitely fed into the Nazi regime, this idea of the Aryan Superman.
Hmm. Well, why do you think we've taken such a huge step back from that? It doesn't seem like mankind has gotten any more virtuous in the past 100 years, and yet we have totally rejected the notion, this notion of eugenics and using science in that kind of way. In fact, it's become so politically correct to be against that both left and right, all spectrums of society, are against it.
Well, the thing is that it's seeping through the back door.
You think it's making a resurgence?
Well, we just had a report from China. It was condemned by the world, but you have scientists, and in particular a Chinese scientist,
right,
who went and modified the genetics of an embryo, and
yes,
and to eliminate some sort of disease. I forget what it was, but this is the kind of the first step of changing the nature of man through his DNA.
So we've got less than 2 minutes, Bob. Do you think we are on the precipice of designer babies? I mean, a lot of people are worried about this. Do you think it's going to happen?
I think it will. And just before we started the show, I was watching a movie called Gattaca, and it was exactly about that topic. And it talked about what happened. It was about the story of a natural born baby who grew into a man, and his brother, who was a designer baby. And they talked about the stratification of society between the designer babies, the ones that were perfect, and those were...
So it seems like in the future we have two paths going on here. The potential of designer babies to try to make perfect human beings that way, and the more Frankenstein-y kind of thing of bionic people, whereas you replace the natural human being with bionic parts.
Right, yes.
They can become Superman in that way. Do you think one of those two paths, do you think both of them are going to be tried, and do you think one of them is going to win out, or do you think mankind is just going to be abolished? Less than a minute.
Okay, well, I think there's a distinct possibility mankind can be abolished, but I think it will be through the genetic path rather than the mechanical path. The mechanical path is certainly possible, but I think genetics is making more progress. We're seeing it.
Yeah,
we're seeing it in ways also through abortion. I mean, we want to have perfect babies, and we're seeing that sort of move.
Sex selection all kinds of things. Getting rid of deformed babies if they're It's a horror show right now. I mean, we're living through a horror show.
Right, and then the next
question is what brand of horror is around the corner? Is we're really asking tonight. When is Christ coming back, Bob? I'll end with that question.
Well, Christ is coming back at the end of time, and I don't know.
Probably before we abolish ourselves as a species, I would imagine.
I think so. I think that is definitely true. Right. We may be hastening the second coming here by this advance in science.
Interesting point. Mr. Bob LeBlanc, got to rush, got to leave, but thank you for an interesting talk on the abolition of man and modern Prometheus. And thank you for listening, everybody. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us tonight. Join us next time for another show on another topic. Have a great week.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.